You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the Marshfield School District is in hot water following allegations last year that two school officials discriminated against a student when they cast actors in their performance of The Sound of Music. We'll get the details. First, the most popular presidential candidate among millennials during the 2016 race was a 75-year-old Democratic socialist. Bernie Sanders held a strong appeal for young voters and one that his Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton struggled to get. As a group, millennials are known to have a more favorable view towards socialism than previous generations did. Andrew Hartman is a professor of history at Illinois State University and author of two books, A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars, and Education and the Cold War, The Battle for the American School. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on, Judith.
Can you paint a picture for us of the millennial leftists that you've written about?
Sure. So obviously this came to people's attention, as you mentioned, in the 2016 Democratic primaries when young people, especially the age group between the 20s and 30s, were flocking to vote for Bernie Sanders. And so the biggest difference in the 2016 Democratic primaries in terms of all of the demographic gaps was the generational gap. And so people have been thinking about this generational gap. I happen to be one of those people, and I'm sort of putting it into historical terms. And the thing that sort of is most striking to begin with is that it seems similar to the generational gap that developed in the 1960s, but the issues are very different. The 1960s issues, of course, that brought young people out into the streets, oftentimes against their parents' generation, was the Vietnam War, first and foremost. Now the issue is the economy, an economy that young people are coming into the job market on since 2008 that has not been kind to them whatsoever. And the expectations for young people now is that they are unlikely to be able to attain the living standards of their parents and grandparents. And so there's a lot of frustration there. And one of the political responses by many young people has been to turn to the left. And so socialism, this longtime American bugaboo, has become somewhat popular amongst many young Americans. And I think it has a lot to do with the economic situation. It also has to do with the fact that these people grew up and came of age after the Cold War. And so there isn't the sort of communist Soviet threat, which of course, for many decades made Americans loathe to support socialist ideas and programs.
And as you said, Andrew, that new left of the 1960s was really coalescing around the anti-war movement, but also more social issues like women's liberation and access to birth control and freer cultural standards for behavior. But you're saying that this economic focus of the current young people who are on the left is really more similar to the old left of the 1930s. Give us a little sense of what the main themes were for that generation.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's my argument. In the 1930s, of course, as hopefully everyone knows if they've taken just the most basic U.S. history class, this is the decade of the Great Depression. It's the greatest crisis in the history of the American economy, the history of capitalism. At one point, a third of the employable people were unemployed, and many, many hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people turned to the left during the 1930s, and the main focus was economics. In the 1930s, even the American Communist Party reached its sort of zenith in terms of numbers and influence, but there were other manifestations of this leftward turn. The labor union movement of that time period became extremely militant. It grew. It extended its reach into a number of different industries where the labor movement had not gone previously. And all of this coalesced to pressure, in many ways, the Democratic Party of Franklin Delano Roosevelt to pass legislation that became the New Deal, that became, I guess, the social democracy that formed the bedrock of the American economy from the 1930s up until maybe the 1980s.
We're talking with Andrew Hartman right now. He's a professor of history at Illinois State University, and we're looking at how millennial leftists today have more in common with the leftists of the 1930s, perhaps, than those of the 1960s. And some, as you said, many people are kind of thinking about this and turning this topic over, Andrew, and some are saying, well, you know, all of these millennial socialists, in quotation marks, don't actually understand what socialism really is, and what they think they're supporting really isn't socialism when you go by the definition. How much credence would you give to that argument?
A little bit. So they're, you know, the millennials who are on the left are a varied group of people. There are an increasing number who I think are becoming pretty sophisticated in their understanding of the theories and history of socialism. But you're right that the majority of Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016 probably didn't have that sort of broad and deep knowledge of socialism. And so for them, socialism might have equated to some of Bernie's platform points, for example, free access to higher education, universal health care. These are the types of extremely popular, ideas, policies, for many Americans, not just millennials, but especially for millennials who are entering the job market not only with not great job prospects, but also with vast amounts of student debt and having a difficult time sort of navigating the healthcare system, even with the advantages of Obamacare. And so you're right that these are just basic sort of social democratic policies that are oftentimes being equated with socialism, which to me speaks to the fact that here as we sit in 2017, the economic situation is so bleak that what would have seemed sort of moderate in the 1950s has become to seem radical or socialist.
You talk about the podcast Chapo Trap House, a popular leftist podcast that you describe as a voice of millennial leftism. Here's a clip of one of the hosts critiquing the reported Democratic Party slogan for the 2018 midterms, which is, quote, a better deal, better skills, better jobs, better wages.
Yeah, back to the actual slogan itself. Better skills is such a tell because, like, that is just like unreconstructed Clinton, third way Clintonism from like way back in the 90s. Like, this is the whole idea that like education is the way out of poverty. That like people just need better education to get the better skills that they need to get the better wages, rather than just saying better jobs, better wages. Putting better skills up front puts the onus on the worker to be like, well, you know, it's really your fault, the reason that your wages have stayed stagnant for 30 or 40 years.
Andrew, what gives this podcast a distinct millennial and leftist flavor for you?
I think it's that it is irreverent in its approach to mainstream Democrats, sort of mainstream liberal media especially. And I think that amongst the millennial left, the coming-of-age leftists, there's a sort of vacuum in terms of the media, and Chapo Trap House and other venues have sort of filled that vacuum. And, you know, they've become wildly popular for it because to the eyes of a lot of these millennial lefts, they're just speaking the truth and a truth that needs to be told.
How much traction do you think the ideas of the millennial left have right now among other millennials, and do they have a chance to influence generations coming up behind them and older than them?
So I think it does have some traction, and one of the things that we might point to is the fact that, you know, when you look at generational political attitudes, they don't tend to change, and so people in their 20s form a political view, and they tend to stick to that view. It sort of goes against the grain of the old adage that young people are liberal and older people are conservative. It's not necessarily true. And so I think it will gain traction, and as the millennial generation grows older and becomes more in positions of leadership, I think we may see this leftward move gain traction. if the economy stays the way it is, I think that younger generations will follow suit. I don't think, though, that the younger generation is necessarily influencing the older generation. And so I think there actually is a generational gap. And oftentimes, historians push back against notions of, you know, like generational difference, because it seems like a way for many commentators to talk about how the present moment is so vastly different than the past, when historians often like to talk about continuity. But I actually think there are moments when this, when it makes sense to talk about generational difference. The 1960s, that made sense, and I think it certainly makes sense right now.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Andrew, the 2018 midterms are coming up. As we said, millennials were largely supportive of Bernie Sanders. What do you think Democrats and the Democratic Party leadership is going to have to do to bring them into the fold and get them excited for the midterms?
Well, I think that we're going to continue to see this divide that we in the Democratic Party that we saw in 2016. It's sort of a war for the soul of the Democratic Party between the Bernie-crats and the sort of mainstream Obama-Clinton leadership. And I think this will continue into 2008. And if the sort of older, more established leadership wants to have an enthusiastic embrace of the party by younger people, they have to make real moves to incorporate some of their views and policies into the mainstream of the party, and they have to not sort of block some of the people, stand in the way of some of the people who want to run for office, who want to run for party leadership positions, who are emerging from the sort of millennial left or Bernie-crat side of the party.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Judith. I really enjoyed it.
Andrew Hartman is professor of history at Illinois State University. He joined us to talk about how a number of millennials on the left are identifying with socialism and the old leftist movements of the 1930s. A casting choice in a school play by two Marshfield school district officials led to a discrimination complaint from a parent and a year-long investigation. That investigation ultimately found that those officials did in fact violate the district's anti-discrimination policy. But getting this story into the light of day proved to be a challenge for a local reporter. Jonathan Anderson joins us now. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Stevens Point, and has been covering this story for the last year. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So set the stage for us. What happened with the Marshfield School District in 2016?
Yeah, so what we know is that two Marshfield School District employees violated a school district anti-discrimination policy last year when they chose the cast of a musical, this being The Sound of Music, based on students' appearances, and had in fact excluded a student who didn't look like others.
What was the district's anti-discrimination policy at that time?
Yeah, so the policy essentially requires that the school district and its employees cannot discriminate against students based on protected classes like race, religion, gender, and it requires, in fact, that students have equal access to all school programs and activities.
And the Marshfield News Herald has been investigating this for over a year at this point. How did you first hear about this issue?
Well, what happened was the school board had met a couple of times, and under state law, they're required to give sort of a minimum amount of disclosure about what they're meeting about. And they said that they were meeting about a personnel investigation. And so the newspaper requested records related to this personnel investigation. And the school district denied release of those records, and we went to court challenging their denial. And ultimately, we prevailed and found that this was the issue that the school board was meeting about, which had prompted the personnel investigation, specifically about two employees who were involved in this discrimination case.
So you, as a reporter, were kind of tipped off by this closed session of the school board, but what actions or events brought it to the attention of the school board in the first place?
Oh, sure. Well, what brought it to the attention of the school board was that what we know is that a parent of a student essentially filed a complaint with the superintendent alleging this discrimination. And at that point, our understanding is that the superintendent was briefing the school board on this issue.
So the complaint was that there were no students of color in this production. What do we know about the district's demographic breakdown that seemed unlikely to this parent that complained?
Right. So to be precise, we don't know the specific basis for the discrimination complaint. The school district argued and a judge agreed that releasing the nature of the discrimination could reveal the identity of the student. But it is true that the parent's complaint did provide a picture of the cast, and that cast appears to be all white. And so what we know is that the school district comprises 88% of white students, and that is, of course, a large amount, but it's not the entire population of the school district.
We're talking with Jonathan Anderson right now. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Stevens Point. We're talking about a story that he's been following for over a year now about discrimination alleged in the Marshfield School District. And what was the initial reaction from the Marshfield superintendent when you first started looking into the story?
Well, the superintendent initially called the matter, quote, a bushel of rumors, and said that it was unfortunate that the community was, quote, exposed to hyped up speculation. I asked the superintendent whether that was consistent with the facts of the case after we got the records, and I didn't get a response back.
Why do you think you faced resistance from the school district over the story?
Well, I think there are probably two key reasons. The first one, of course, is that, I think any school district, any governmental agency, does not want to be portrayed in a negative light. And certainly this raises serious questions about the racial climate in the school district. And, to be completely honest, it does not, paint a very good picture in some respect. I think they also were legitimately concerned about protecting the student's identity. They argued that none of the information in the records could be redacted, and we argued that they not only they could be, but they had to be redacted.
Blacked out, basically, right?
That's right, blacked out, yeah. Essentially blacking out the identifying information of the student, but keeping intact information that would reveal the substance of the complaint. And, it's very possible that they were earnestly concerned about that issue, and so that may be another reason why they didn't want to release this information.
And so, John, as a reporter, when you are not getting what you feel you need to inform the public from the people involved, what's your next step then? What are your options?
Well, I mean, certainly we try to talk with as many people as possible. That's official sources, of course, but also in this case, people in the community, students, parents, that kind of thing. Here we had filed a records request, and when the school district denied the records request, we challenged that denial in court. And ultimately, a judge ordered release of those records, and that was really a key element here, is that we were able to enforce the open records law to produce this information.
So what kind of response has there been from the school district in following up on this? You said there was the closed session of the school board. Do we know what came out of that? Has there been any discipline?
There has not been any discipline against the two employees who were involved in this case. The investigation found that there was substantial evidence that discrimination had occurred. However, the investigation also found that the two employees did not discriminate intentionally, and for that reason, the superintendent said that disciplinary action was not warranted. However, we do know that the school board, since this matter, has revised its non-discrimination policy to apply more broadly to school programs and student activities.
And do you feel confident that were a similar situation to come up in the future, that this new policy would lead to a better outcome?
I think the answer is hopefully yes. I'm not sure that I can say definitively, of course. I can also say that the school district has said that it would do training with employees to, I guess, better educate them about non-discrimination issues. And I think all of those things combined, hopefully, will prevent these kinds of issues from occurring in the future.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Anderson is a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Stevens Point. He joined us today to talk about a complaint leveled against the Marshfield School District for discrimination against a student in casting for a school play. President Donald Trump is pushing Senate Republicans to take up health care again after three failed votes on the Affordable Care Act just last week. The president tweeted that unless Republicans are, quote, total quitters, end quote, they will try again to repeal and replace Obamacare. But Senate Republicans have already started talking about working on a Trump judicial nominee and other issues this week. Paul Nolette joins us now. He's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, great to be here.
What do you make of the president's tweets about Senate Republicans trying yet again on health care?
Well, it's quite interesting because I think the last few weeks and even months has really shown that Republicans can't come to a compromise even within their own party about how to proceed on health care. And so the idea that they'll still kind of, you know, spend weeks and months on health care and really getting nowhere seems pretty unlikely to me. So it is pretty surprising, I think, that you have the president coming in saying, hey, don't give up, because as long as they're kind of still trying to get health care done, they can't do anything else like tax reform.
So given that, why do you think President Trump is pushing so hard on continuing to try to get a repeal and replace measure passed in the Senate?
I think the big thing is that he really wants to have a big policy win, which hasn't happened yet so far in his presidency. And this seemed like maybe the best place to go right from the beginning, because after all, Republicans for several years have been saying, hey, we think Obamacare is a disaster. We need to repeal it, replace it with something that'll work better. And so I think from President Trump's perspective, that was a issue that really he expected a win on, and he didn't get it. So I think he's trying to use, in this case, the power of Twitter to try to persuade Congress to move forward on that issue.
Would you say it's typical for a president to weigh in so heavily on the legislative branch's agenda and priorities, at least out in public versus maybe in closed-door meetings?
It's not unusual that a president would get involved in the legislative process. That happens quite a bit. But like you kind of implied with that question, too, a lot of times it's done behind closed doors in negotiations with individual senators, individual representatives. But in this case, you have the unusual situation of the president not really getting all that much involved in the health care policy throughout the entire process, but instead using Twitter to, in some ways, almost berate Congress to continue with health care and to try to get something done. And as we've seen, that's had pretty limited success to this point. I mean, one thing that's, I think, true of most senators is that they don't really like being told what to do a lot of times. And so in this case, it really hasn't been able to move the ball forward, at least purely that public pressure on Congress coming from President in his Twitter account.
So some analysts are lining it up as three potential paths of action that the president has tweeted out about health care. And let's go into those in some detail. The first is that he is threatening to cut off payments that insurers are owed for lowering deductibles under Obamacare. What actually are those payments going to the insurers for?
So this one is really the big one, and it's something that's known as a cost-sharing reduction. And the way that this works is that the Affordable Care Act set up a bunch of requirements for insurance companies to provide insurance to lower-income individuals. But in order to try to make that at least profitable for the insurance companies to offer this sort of insurance, the government was going to pay a number of these subsidies to the insurance companies to make up for those lower amounts that for the deductibles and premiums for lower income individuals. And so, long story short, if those were cut off, then that insurance going to lower income individuals would be extremely unprofitable for insurance companies, and they'd have to make up the difference somewhere, and it would probably be raising premiums all across the board.
So were those payments to be cut off from the insurers, it's not that the insurance companies would likely just, you know, swallow that loss. It would be passed on to other consumers.
Right, because after all, the Affordable Care Act still has these requirements that lower income individuals have access to health care. And so you'd have insurance companies still offering these plans but not getting the money to help out make up for the losses that they're getting in those programs. So inevitably, they're going to have to try to make that up somewhere.
And the second item that the president has tweeted about something of a threat to Congress if they don't act is cutting off the subsidies for their own health care. Does he have the power to do that?
He does, actually. And the reason for this is kind of an obscure thing. but one thing that the Affordable Care Act did, among many other things, was that it shifted members of Congress and their staff to Obamacare from the federal health care program that most employees are in. Now, under the old program, the staff members and the members of Congress essentially got these subsidies to help drive down the premiums, and it did so in a pretty substantial amount. But one thing that the Affordable Care Act didn't do, at least not explicitly in the language, is say that those subsidies would continue when they shifted from the federal employee system that everyone else is on in the government to Obamacare. And so back in 2013, the Obama administration said, oh, yeah, we think that system should continue and these subsidies to members of Congress and staff should continue. But that's exactly what Trump is targeting right now. And because the legislative language is very ambiguous on that point, there's a strong argument to be made that he does have the power to cut that off.
Well, and I want to point out something that you just said, that it's not just members of Congress, but also their staff. And while it could be argued that members of Congress are quite well paid, there are a lot of staffers working for them that are probably making significantly less and would then have to pay pretty high health care premiums to cover themselves and their families.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, members of Congress make in the six figures, so not necessarily the most sympathetic group, not to mention that Congress's approval rating is so low. But that's exactly right. Actually, this would affect far greater than just the members of Congress themselves. It would affect the hundreds and really thousands of staff members that work in Congress, and so who aren't making six figures. So it would have a broader impact than I think the Trump administration, President Trump himself, when he announced this, I think he was trying to say, hey, look, I'm going to go right to your pocketbook, senators and representatives, through this cutting off these subsidies. But in reality, it's going to affect a lot larger group of people as well.
And finally, the third action that the president has tweeted as a possibility is blocking all legislation until lawmakers pass health care. That seems like a pretty drastic measure to be threatening.
Well, and it's also the one, unlike the first two, where the administration has a lot more power to do that sort of thing. this is one area that, due to separation of powers, I mean, the president can't demand that the House or Senate take up or not take up a particular bill. And so if the Senate decides, you know what, we're done with health care, and this is what Senator Mitch McConnell has said, if we're done with health care and we want to move on to tax reform, then that's what the Senate's going to do. And there's nothing that the president can do directly to say, no, you can't do that. So this one, I think, was more of kind of a public threat to Congress to continue with health care, but not one that's going to have a whole lot of bite behind it.
I guess perhaps he could choose not to sign something that ended up on his desk, but that's not really stopping them from doing it.
Right, and I think in that case, I would bet Congress would, you know, call him out on his bluff if it is indeed a bluff, because I think if there was a comprehensive tax reform bill that made it to his desk that President Trump liked and the Republican Party likes, I find it very unlikely that he would veto it simply because they turned away from health care to turn to tax reform. So I think from Congress's point of view, they're saying, look, we just want to get a big piece done, one big piece of our agenda done. It's clear that health care is not going to be that piece, so let's move on, regardless of what President Trump is saying on Twitter.
We're talking now with Paul Nolet from Marquette University about President Trump's public pressure on Senate Republicans to try again to repeal and replace Obamacare. And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Do you think Senate Republicans should try again with health care? Or do you think they should take up other issues like tax reform or confirming appointments? What do you think the Republican Party should do about health care now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a minute here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our discussion now with Paul Nolet from the Political Science Department at Marquette University about what Senate Republicans should tackle next. And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the president's tweets about Senate Republicans trying again with health care? Is that your top priority? What issues would you like to see the Senate tackle next? Call in and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to the phones, and Jim in Rice Lake is up. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm not going to criticize the president's agenda. I'm a Democrat. All I'm simply saying is he has no substantial relationship with the Republican Party. In the 18 months he ran as president, he was essentially hostile to them, if not downright rude, without repeating the language he used, because I'm in a civilized program here. But, I mean, he should understand that they may have certain he should coexist with them in terms of certain priorities, because he's had little or no legislative accomplishments in his time so far in office. And he has a desire to, if he wants to win, as he's always saying, to achieve some legislative accomplishment. So it would be wise for him to put the tweet down and maybe have some meetings with Republican Party leadership. And I'll be interested in your guest comments off the air.
Thanks so much for that call, Jim. And Paul, he ran as an outsider, and now he's something of an outsider on these issues.
Well, and I think Jim is right there, too, that he had a lot of harsh language for Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders throughout the entire campaign. And really, a lot of that's continued as he has been president. And as we have been talking about with the president's recent tweets about threatening taking away some money that goes towards congressional health care, those sorts of threats, especially given the fact that Trump had a rocky relationship with the Republican Party to begin with, I mean, I don't think that those are really helping. I mean, I don't see those really moving the ball forward on whether it's health care or tax reform or a number of other issues. I think in terms of how President Trump has approached tax reform yet, and there's still a lot of details that need to be ironed out, but it seems like they're largely on the same page, Republican leadership and the president. So I think, as Jim suggested there, maybe get off of Twitter and start working on the details with Congress on tax reform and other issues would probably be more productive. But of course, so far we haven't seen any indication that that's going to happen.
And has there been a direct response to those tweets from President Trump from the top Senate Republicans?
Well, I think the main response has been mostly silent for the most part. And Mitch McConnell, among others, has pretty explicitly said, look, we tried on health care. We're moving on. It didn't work out. We're moving on to tax reform. So I think that's been generally the response here, saying, look, I mean, the president can say we need to work on health care and threaten us to work on this issue, but we're going to go ahead and work on the issues that we think we can actually get an accomplishment done on. And so I think that's been really the main response so far.
Let's take another call. Joan from Eau Claire is up. Hi, Joan.
Hi, good afternoon. My comment is that Donald Trump wants to negate everything that Barack Obama has done, and Barack had the very huge push for the Affordable Care Act. What I'm not seeing out of any of these Republicans, other than three of these senators, is any compassion. There's no level of compassion whatsoever. What I do see out of them is I feel a lot of hatred, and I'm not sure why that is. I would like to see some compassion, because that was the whole point of the Affordable Care Act to begin with. I'm not sure that we are going to see it, which is very regrettable, but that is what I would like to see. That's my comment, and thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thanks for that call, Joan. And Paul, we hear a lot from the Republicans that they are trying to repeal and replace Obamacare because it is oppressive for people. Premiums are going up. People are not getting the coverage they need. Joan is saying that the Affordable Care Act brought good things to people.
Yeah, and I think from the Republicans' perspective, they're saying, look, we think that the Affordable Care Act is both not working as it should, or as how any sort of healthcare program should work. And we also have some concerns about government kind of mandating that you buy insurance and that sort of thing. But of course, the problem that they ran into, as I think Joan identified here, is that a lot of people did see the Republican plan that actually was on the table over the last few weeks as being hurtful to a lot of people. And so when those numbers came out from the Congressional Budget Office and other sources as well, saying if this passed and was signed into law, then 20-plus million people would lose their health insurance, that really had a big effect on much of the American public. And it was one of the reasons why, as unpopular as Obamacare has been over time, and even now it's, you know, in the mid-40s or so in terms of approval, the Republicans' health care plan was way lower, talking about 20% approval ratings and that sort of thing, for that legislation to pass. And so for a lot of Republicans, it just became a hot potato that really they couldn't deal with.
Paul, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Paul Nolet is assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He joined us to talk about what might be up next for Senate Republicans. More than 65 people have been shot and killed in Milwaukee this year. The murders devastate families and communities. This week, WPR has been taking a closer look at gun violence. Today, Ross Terrell brings you the story of one of these murders and its aftermath.
He was nice to everyone.
February 16th, 2017, really a day Nora Sheridan says changed her life. She was at work when she got a call from Milwaukee police saying something happened at her home and they needed to go inside to investigate. She rushed home to meet with a detective.
He was kind of being vague, and he said that the house is intact, but he noticed that the car that was sitting in the backyard, the car door was open and the back door was open, and they found my son in here, and he had multiple gunshot wounds.
Rainier Sheridan was dead. He was 36 years old. The person responsible for taking his life has not been found. Sheridan carries that with her daily.
Sometimes I feel like I'm going to sink into depression, you know, but only thing that's keeping me motivated is trying to find out the truth on what happened to him and the people that I have support from.
According to data from the Milwaukee Police Department, there were more than 150 homicides last year. A little more than 80% of the victims were shot. Each lost life presents a unique challenge for family and friends left to grapple with the loss. The ripple effect of violence is not lost on city officials. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn spoke at a recent event in the city aimed at connecting officials with faith leaders to help spread peace. He acknowledged the widespread impact violence has on communities.
Violence takes a toll on all of us. It takes a toll on the active victims of violence, takes a toll on the psychology of communities, takes a toll on the police. Don't think it doesn't.
The impact from Rainier Sheridan's murder was felt throughout the neighborhood. Nora Sheridan recalls a night she heard gunshots. She didn't call the police, and the next day she found out neither did her neighbor.
We were scared because they might come and retaliate. Because you never know if the police come directly to your house and somebody might be watching. And there's people who just don't want to get involved, who don't want to talk, but I think we support each other in fear.
Sheridan participates in grief support programs but is struggling financially. She was laid off from a company she worked for 15 years and now makes a third of her previous income. Janice Gordon is the founder of a burial fund for victims of violence in the city. She says violence impacts the family way before it reaches the community.
I had this one young lady who lost her child. She was so sad she couldn't go to work. She lost her house. She put her furniture in storage. The storage flooded, so she lost her furniture. Talk about a ripple effect. I mean, we didn't even get to her community.
Gordon says she tries to support those affected by violence financially and in other areas.
The whole goal of this agency is to get people back on their feet and get them started in their new norm, because it's a new norm. When you have a child that's 30, you had that child for 30 years and now they're gone.
Nora Sheridan is still working on getting to her new norm. She says getting there depends on eventually leaving Milwaukee.
Why am I staying here when I know what happened to him? But then on the other hand, I would love to be part of a solution to help our young people to find a purpose in life instead of resorting to killing somebody over something senseless.
The violence usually peaks in the summer. Last August, Milwaukee endured its deadliest month in 25 years. Sheridan plans on spending the summer with her 15 and 7-year-old grandkids, their first without their dad. She says they have handled the loss of their dad very differently, but are trying to move forward. She says her faith and the support of her neighbors have allowed her to carry on. Ross Terrell, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This series concludes tomorrow with a look at what's being done to stop the violence in Milwaukee. Tune in during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Central Time, and online at WPR.org.